What's up, Doc?
Hello and welcome to Therapy Insiders. I'm Dr. Gene Shirakabrad, joined with my colleague and close friend, Dr. Joe Palmer. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Gene.
So, give you guys a little introduction. This will be a weekly to bi-weekly podcast show covering various topics from therapy techniques, therapy philosophy, to various other rehab topics.
We're going to provide patient-centered information for clinicians and hopefully allow them to use what they hear and integrate it into their clinical practice.
We'll do our best to cut through some of the BS out there. I know there's a lot of fads, a lot of popular techniques and treatments out, and we're going to do our best to get in touch with the clinicians leading the charge in a lot of these, whether good or bad, and do our best to poke and prod and get the proper information out for you guys to do as you see fit.
And in the end, we're going to give you our opinion. We'd love to hear from you. Send us some comments. We'll get you on the air.
Email us at insiders@therapyinsiders.com, and we'll do our best to answer all our questions in the podcast show. And if not, we'll definitely get back to you in the emails. A little bit about us. We are both manual therapists. We have been through a fairly rigorous certification program with Jim Meadows, who will be one of our first guests in an interview segment. You guys will hear covering various topics, very interesting. Get Jim's opinion on therapy techniques and future, past, and present in physical therapy. And we will also look at topics ranging from manual therapy to sports rehab, again, with the guests that we feel like are the prominent therapists or experts in the field.
But we want to make this what you want to listen to. So if you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, again, send us that email.
So one of the first things in terms of manual therapy is really talking about what the heck is manual therapy. What is it? What is it defined as? A lot of people throw around the term manual therapist. I know today I did a running clinic at a local run shop, and a lot of the people I saw, you know, I asked them, have you had PT before? And a lot of them said, yeah, we had a lot of hands-on therapy. And I was like, well, what did that hands-on therapy include? Did you get your hips looked at? Did you get your pelvis looked at? They said, no, you know, they kind of did some soft tissue work, some soft tissue release, and exercises. So how do you feel about that, Joe? Do you feel like doing a little soft tissue work is manual therapy?
I don't. I feel like it is a part of a whole. It is something that provides what I believe to be temporary relief. However, if you don't get the underlying structural issue under control, then you are putting a Band-Aid on something, and you're not doing the patient justice. Now, that being said, I do believe that it has a place in treatment, and that it needs to be used. But I do like to dig a little deeper, and I think that's important. I think it's important for everybody to understand what techniques are considered manual therapy, and to educate your patient about that. I feel like as a profession, we don't necessarily do a great job of educating our patient on what we're doing, why we're doing it, and why we are different than a personal trainer who would give them exercises, or a massage therapist who would give them soft tissue massage.
And also chiropractors, because I know you and I both do joint manipulation quite often, obviously when indicated. But that's one of the main questions I get is, how is this different from chiropractic? Or if you're doing joint needling, how is this different than acupuncture? And you know, patient education is, again, important, like you said, not only so they know what's going on to them, but they so they know how different this would be if they went to a chiropractor, if they went to an acupuncturist. But I agree with you. I think the question you always have to ask yourself is why. And people that are doing a ton of soft tissue mobilizations, myofascial release, whatever the heck you want to call it, it's essentially a glorified massage. You know, you'll feel better, but you're not figuring out what the underlying cause is, just like all the other stuff out there, muscle confusion, all that other stuff with muscles. You know, muscles in themselves are pretty stupid things. They're told what to do. And aside from a traumatic injury to the muscle or some kind of degenerative condition, there's always an input. There's always a cause to the muscle tightness or perceived tightness. And if you don't figure that out, you're only going to give temporary relief and you're not really doing the patient justice. Unless you just want them to keep coming back in, then you have a pretty good business model, but not very ethical.
So back to that educational piece. When your patient does ask you, how do you explain to them what you're doing as far as in a way that they can understand?
Be as simple as possible. Most patients have a good idea of what the spine is, and they have an idea of nerves. They just don't have a good idea of putting two together, how the nerves work the muscles. I know a lot of them are, you know, they hear disc herniation or disc bulge, and a lot of them, you know, that's to them the cause of their pain, not so much understanding that disc herniations in themselves are most likely painless unless pushing on a nerve ending. So I do my best with, you know, I usually grab a model of the spine and kind of explain to them how input works from the nerves to the muscles and what tightness is and what sore muscles are and what tenderness is and all that and how you fix the cause versus just doing some myofascial work. What about you?
Yeah, I like to explain to them that everything has a place, but unless I find the cause of what's leading them to this dysfunction, they're going to be back to see me, and it's just going to be temporary. So I do try to break it down and to tell them exactly what I'm feeling and what joints I feel are not moving the way that they should, and try to give them in its simplest form a reason why that is contributing to their dysfunction. If you can break it down to just, this is why it's not moving the way it should, and this is the dysfunction that I see, then they can comprehend and are very much ready to take the next step as far as treatment's concerned.
Yeah, I think also patient education only gets you so far. If you tell them what's going on, but then you don't back it up with what you're doing, they'll come in and then they won't see them too often again. So you have to do something that differentiates you from other therapists, other clinicians. You know, because it is a business, as altruistic as we want to be. If you're really good at what you do, not only will your patients get better, your business model will get better as well. That's how word spreads about what you can do. And honestly, you know, when patients go back to their physicians, referring physicians, friends, and whatnot, they say, hey, this guy, you know, I've been to 2-3 different other PTs, one chiropractor, and this guy actually got his hands on me, and he was very thorough. He looked at my pelvis. He looked at my hips. And, you know, they'll go back and say crazy things that you never said to them, but they process it in their head, you know. He manipulated my this, and that, when all he did was assess their nominates. But just having that, just on that, that's already more than most PTs will do. I think you definitely need to know what you're doing. You can be the best educator in the world, but if you don't back it up with your skill, you're wasting your time. So another one of the things that we'll cover with Jim Meadows is An integrative approach, and that has various meanings. You know, we talk about manual therapy, and usually the number one thing that pops into people's heads is hands-on techniques, as we've kind of been talking about. Now, there's a debatable, a significantly debatable amount of information on what techniques are useful, and also we'll discuss this later, but to me, I think you need to have a very comprehensive approach, and when you're doing manual therapy, where you find the biomechanical dysfunction, and then you do your neuro-rehab on top of it, whether that's exercises or actual neurologic movements such as PNF or task-specific exercise. That's dependent on the patient and the problem, but I think you can't have one versus the other. You can't have a manual therapist just doing hands-on things without doing the rehab on top, and I don't think just having a sports therapist doing exercises, you'll get the same benefit. Obviously, there's exceptions. If you're dealing with high-level athletes post-surgery, that's one thing. But even then, you can make an example of biomechanical dysfunctions. So I truly think you need to have both of the components to be truly successful.
I agree with that. I think that does separate you, providing both components, you know, not just the treating the restriction, but treating the whole movement pattern and the whole person. I feel like when my patients ask me that question about what makes this different from chiropractic, I go to that. I say that that I'm going to take it a step further. And there are chiropractors that do that. And I tell them that there are good and bad in every profession. And I say that when you find a good provider, you need to hold on to that. But that being said, I think on the large scale, that is what separates a manual physical therapist from a chiropractor.
Well, I say similar things to my patients because we are functional movement experts, and we'll talk about functional later, but we are movement experts, right? So one of the things I tell my patients rather bluntly is I really don't care about your pain. Don't get me wrong. I don't want you to be in pain because that limits your function and movement. But pain is a means to an end. So that's one of the topics I cover is how is this different than chiropractors? Well, chiropractors mainly treat pain. And there's a new school, obviously, of chiropractors that also practice, you know, quote unquote, physical therapy, which is a topic we'll discuss later in itself. But to me, you know, pain is a symptom. It's just a piece of the puzzle that I'm trying to solve. And you want to get through it, but you want to get through the pain so they can do X, Y, and Z, not just have pain. And I think a lot of us get lost in that. And a lot of times is, how do we get rid of this pain? How do we get rid of this pain? And why we're getting rid of the pain gets kind of lost in the shuffle sometimes. And I think you kind of have to step back and figure that out.
I agree. We are pain focused. And I think that's because the patient brings us back to that. Every time they walk in the clinic, and so it's important. But again, your ultimate goal is to get them back to what they want to do.
Well, I don't know if you get this or not, but I get patients that are sent to me after they see 2-3 different PTs. And by the time they get to me, they're kind of trained. So I ask them, you know, tell me about what's hurting. Tell me what's going on. They're like, well, my pain's about a 2. And before I even ask them, you know, the number scale, which bothers me as is, you know, I want to know the quality. I want to know what they're feeling. You know, use real human words. But they're so trained to go by the numbers, and they just say, yeah, my pain's a 2. My pain's a 3 today. Well, that's great that your pain's a 2 or a 3, but that means absolutely nothing to me. You know, just like, oh, yeah, you're patient 2 to me today. You know? Numbers are numbers, and they're great if you want to use them as objective measures. But, you know, come on, figure out what the pain is, one that's going to actually make you feel like you're treating a human being, and two, you'll know what the cause is, right? You want to know the quality of the pain. You want to know exactly what they're feeling. You know, lancinating pain is different than aching pain. You want to know that kind of stuff. If patients are just telling you numbers, again, you're not doing them service, and you're, quite honestly, I think you're wasting your time. So in future episodes, we will cover various topics ranging from dry needling to joint manipulation, sports therapy. We have some pretty high-level guests lined up to interview and discuss these topics. And we were lucky enough to kick off the party with none other than Jim Meadows, world-renowned physical therapist and lecturer, instructor. And for those of you that don't know about Jim, I just go ahead and Google his name because his resume is way too long and way, 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 way too boring for me to list through. I know I'll be asleep. I know Joe will definitely be asleep. That's not a pretty thing. A lot of snoring. And let's just skip the details. But Jim is probably, I would say...
he's pretty good.
Yeah, you know, if you want to go arguably one of the top five manual therapists in the world, who the other four are, I have no idea, but he's definitely top five. He's if you look through the top PTs practicing right now, I'd say at some point or another they've had Jim in their course list for better or for worse, better technique wise, worse probably socially, but we won't get into that too much. He is he's an outspoken guy, but he's earned the right to be outspoken at this point, and most of the things that he's outspeaking about are spot on and correct. I would say, what do you think?
I think that he's well read, and that knowledge base provides him the foundation for his ability to be outspoken.
But not a ton of gray area with Jim. There's
yeah, you're not gonna get shades of gray. There's no 50 shades of gray with Jim. Also a good thing.
I don't know what you're talking about. Never read the book. but anyway, yeah, there's not a ton. But again, the black and white is pretty useful. And I know I've been successful with the stuff that I've learned from him. Very much manipulation based, but also big emphasis on differential diagnosis. He thinks in illness scripts. It's essentially pattern recognition, which what most MDs follow and use. And quite successful. I know I've been successful with it.
It's given me a foundation and a way to break down each evaluation and minimize your trials of different techniques that might not be the way you should go. So it helps you to keep you from making mistakes, and gives you a strong foundation to standardize your evaluation.
Very true. So coming up, we have part one of Jim Meadows' interview, 3-part total. So you'll see the episodes pop up in iTunes. Also visit therapyinsiderspod.com, and we'll have some description and some articles from Jim, also some techniques that you can see some manipulations and descriptions of that. But in our interview with Jim, we'll discuss various topics, again, dealing with physical therapy in general, dealing with joint manipulations, differential diagnosis, and his thoughts on state of physical therapy. So stay tuned. Part one coming up. All right, this is Therapy Insiders, and our big guest today is a world-renowned physical therapist, has been doing it for a few decades now, all over the world. It's Jim Meadows with us. So we're going to cover a few topics with Jim, ranging from manipulations to just theories on techniques. So Jim, you've obviously been practicing joint manipulation for a little while. Where do you think manipulation is headed at this point?
That's in physical therapy.
In physical therapy.
Because chiropractic is taking a bit of a beating, particularly in Canada at the moment. In physical therapy, actually, you should see a lot more usage of it, given that the schools are mandated to be teaching this thing to pre-professional students. So providing the students are essentially brave enough to use them, not that they should, you need bravery for this, but yeah, I mean, you should see an increase in the use of them.
Well, that's an interesting point you brought up, bravery. There's, I'm sure, still floating around a lot of, I guess, misconception that joint manipulation is dangerous. You think that's the case?
I think it can be dangerous. I think there's at least two aspects of this, and that's patient selection, technique, and the technique itself. And I think, like every other technique in medicine or PT, low dosage is where you want to go, the lowest dose possible, which also includes the amount of force you're using. But yeah, of course it can be dangerous. Any effective treatment technique can be dangerous.
And you mentioned Canada with chiropractors and the heat that they're taking right now.
Mm, yeah.
Is that in relation to their techniques? Or?
No, it's in relation to the incidence of vertebral artery injuries. I'm a bit out of touch with Canada at the moment, but essentially, last time I heard about this, and I don't see any reason why it changes, there's a group called the Stroke Consortium, made up mostly of neurologists and neurosurgeons who are sort of following vertebral artery injuries from manipulation. And basically, they're targeting chiropractors simply because chiropractors are doing most of the manipulation and are causing most of the arterial injuries. So they are hitting them pretty hard, and they are getting a fair amount of heat up there. The other aspect of the problem the chiropractors have, and I'm certainly not happy about this, they're being threatened all the time by evidence. Where's the evidence for what you claim? And a lot of their claims fall outside of our scope, visceral effects and autonomic response, and that sort of thing fall outside of our scope of practice. I really don't have any comment about them. But the evidence-based arguments against chiropractic, I think, are somewhat spurious. I mean, you have to look at the number of patients who are receiving this, and this isn't like a cult. This has been going on for 150 years. So while evidence has its place in this, I mean, the evidence has to be good evidence.
Well, speaking of evidence, if we talk about C-spine manipulations and vertebral artery, what has the evidence shown in terms of the likelihood or the danger of actually causing a stroke?
All over the place. Again, this is not good evidence from a rigorous scientific perspective, because it's tough to do with a study that does this. But so almost all of these surveys, which is really what they come down to, are full of fallacy. Probably the worst one came from a study amongst American neurologists, neurosurgeons a few years back in California, and they put the number at 1 in 5,000 manipulations causing a stroke. But then it turns out the same stroke was being reported by half a dozen or more physicians. So there was no control on the reporting aspect of this. So you go from that 1 in 5,000 to chiropractic schools reporting none in 10 million. The Swedish study suggested 1 in 400,000. So basically, just take the pick of the one you want, depending on what your argument's going to be for or against. There really isn't good numbers on this. What's reasonable to say, though, is that chiropractors produce more injuries. They are doing more manipulations, and then maybe the techniques more, the artery is more vulnerable to their techniques, but there's no evidence of that. So, I don't know.
So what could PTs, physical therapists, do if they plan on doing, if they were taught a spinal manipulation but haven't really been taught good assessments for vertebral artery? What can they do to minimize the risk of a stroke?
Well, I think you've got to look. First off, you stay away from older people who are likely to have atherosclerotic problems anyway.
What would be older?
60 and above, 70 maybe, but the ones that we're really worried about are the traumatic injuries to the arteries. And assuming that we're not talking about actually causing a traumatic incident, because that's a whole different issue, but basically you want to exclude patients who may have a traumatic injury to it. There are symptoms that suggest it, but dizziness, headache, neck pain. So I think a thorough history where you can show that the dizziness isn't being caused by an arterial problem, but is being caused by the neck problem, is part of the initial discussions anyway. So I think you've got to investigate each of the symptoms separately and then basically associate and disassociate them from each other until the point where you're comfortable. Physical testing, I'm still a fan of doing physical testing, progressive declines, minimized declines, that sort of thing. I don't think there's enough evidence to say this doesn't work because, again, the studies they're using are Doppler studies on mostly, well, they are non-pathologic subjects. And to me, it's like doing an ACL stress test when the ACL is not torn and say, look, it doesn't work. I think unless there's definitive proof not to do this type of test, then it should be done because the risk of doing it, providing you exclude obvious VVI problems before you do the test, the risk of doing this test is no worse than doing Sperling's test, for God's sake. So I'm still a fan of this. But I also think that what you should be aware when you've done these tests is, first off, not have too much confidence in negative tests, simply because we don't know how good they are. But have a lot of confidence in positive ones that reproduce neurological signs or symptoms and don't touch them. So this is as much as anything for saying, I don't think these tests are going to tell you that it's safe to do it, but what it should do is say it's probably safe to do it.
So let's, to clarify a little bit, are we talking about every facet of the spine that you're manipulating, or are we just talking about a certain portion of the neck that is at a higher risk?
Well, yeah, there is a higher risk apparently in the cranio-vertebrals.
Which will be which joints?
Probably, well, certainly C1, C2, and the occiput. It may well include C2-3. There looks to be a more, not just from vertebral artery stuff, but trauma, there seems to be more concentration of injuries in that part of the spine than the other. But certainly dissections and injuries to the artery do occur lower down. So I don't think it's the sort of thing we should be talking about probabilities. It's probably not going to happen at C5-6 because the effects are so catastrophic if you're wrong. I think you should be careful on all of this.
What I'm hearing from you, Jim, is that you're a fan of the technique. It's the inclusion and exclusion process that is really important.
Yeah.
As far as...
Yeah. In fact, I've suggested on a couple of presentations now that we should change the positive for the VBI test from simple reproduction of dizziness and headache into the manifestation of neurological signs and symptoms. Now, if you do that, you've actually got pretty much a perfect test. Because if the test is producing neurological signs and symptoms, and that includes doing cranial nerve assessments as well when they are dizzy, but when this is happening, I can't think of a benign cause that would explain those cranial nerve or long tract signs and symptoms from moving the neck other than VBI, possibly undiagnosed migraine. But even there, you need to get that diagnosed. So the onset of that, if you assume that it is a serious neurological or neurovascular condition, it's going to stop you from doing a lot of damage if that occurs. If it doesn't occur, I don't think that you can definitively say there isn't a VBI problem. But what you can say is the history leading up to that test, everything in the subject or exam leading that test, allowed me to do that test because there is nothing suggesting this is arterial. So your pre-test probability should be very low that it's a vertebral artery problem. So you do the test, and when the test is negative, that should actually bring that post-test probability up to a very high level. But it's always to a very high level, not to a level where you can say, well, it isn't that. So you've always got to be considering that.
So there's a lot of clinical prediction rules out there for neck pain, for manipulation, and some are somewhat useful. But based on what you're saying is, if you follow a solid examination, verbal examination, and then you do your assessment, palpation, that's a lot more useful or a lot more precise than just following X and going by boxes. To make a diagnosis.
Clinical prediction rules are not diagnostic rules. And I think this is something that the people who make these prediction rules should emphasize. It's a prognostic rule. If you do this, the chances of it helping this patient is this. This is not a diagnostic tool. And if you use these prognostic tools as the diagnostic tools, you're going to screw up big time at some point. And I think it's incumbent on the people who produce these clinical prediction rules to say exactly that. They should not be used for diagnosis. They're not diagnostic tools.
So based on that, what would you consider an indication to manipulate what you would call illness scripts?
Yeah, I think the typical segmental dysfunction, and my indication of doing it is a segmental mechanical dysfunction. I don't think I'll get much argument from this from most clinicians. What you've got is fairly local pain. The referral's minimum to moderate. The severity of the pain is moderate. The loss of movement is into either flexion or extension. It's usually episodic. You should be able to palpate either hypertonicity of the multifidi or hypotonicity of the multifidi. And you should, on your biomechanical assessment, be able to identify the hypomobility and the direction of the hypomobility. So that, for me, would basically operationally define a joint that would be manipulated. And no contraindications.
Which would be what?
Well, it's all a matter of tolerances and intolerances. So anything that won't allow the patient to tolerate the manipulation, that goes from everything from emotional, psychological, right the way through to weak bones, bleeding disorders, usually because of drugs and so on. So providing they can structurally, mentally, emotionally tolerate the manipulation, do the manipulation. I don't think a manipulation is the last resort when mobilizations fail. The indications to do this is entirely of itself, and this is a treatment of choice when you get those indications.
So you always palpate, right? Before you do any kind of technique, you want to assess the joint that you're going to be treating, whether it's mobilization or manipulation.
Yeah.
So I know one of the big things you always discuss is end feel. Could you run through different end feels and what end feel you really want to feel and what it actually feels like that you would want to manipulate or not manipulate?
Yeah. I was brought up by Syriacs, basically. We had him as a student. I went to his clinic a few times. So basically, I was brought up with Syriacs. And the big thing with Syriacs, apart from the logical consistency of examination, which is debatable as far as the validity is concerned, but the big thing there was about infield. Now, he divided them up into capsular, bony, spasm, and so on and so on and so on. But I honestly don't think these categories work that easily. I think the normal infields are combinations of different tissues affecting the way the joint stops moving when you're pushing it. So a lot of this is not exactly arbitrary, but you're labeling, it's almost an arbitrary labeling of what you're feeling. So it's much more important that you turn around and say, yeah, this is normal, this is abnormal, and then try to analyze what the abnormality is. For me, for a manipulation, this thing should be jammed up. Not bony and unyielding, but there's a springiness to it, but you ain't going to get any further with it. For me, that's the end feel of a biomechanically dysfunctional joint.